because they already operate off the hit roll. You don't want to make that hit roll so good math-wise that the mechanic is just the only thing that matters.
Spike scan initiated. I'm picking up a podcast arriving. Wait. Designation: Forge the Narrative.
Hey everybody, welcome to Forge the Narrative. My name is Paul, your host. We are the Battle of Lost Souls podcast. I'm joined by Adam Camilleri.
Evening, everybody.
And Tanya Gates.
Hey everybody.
Red may be joining us after the break, so you know if he's back after that, that'd be great. He is working, you know, balancing all the schedules around the world, international people on this show.
I know, like, as if he can't take time off his very busy, extremely important work to get on this show for you guys. I mean, the disrespect.
He's trying to make it here. We're going to cut him some slack, of course, just one day. You know, in case there's a voice coming in, a sassy voice after the break, I don't want to alarm anybody.
That's why I'm getting my sass in early, so he can pay me back in kind on the back end.
There's some cool things coming down the way here. Later on, there's going to be an infusion of Warhammer 40,000 into Magic the Gathering. Now, this is probably not news to folks that follow that side of the gaming community, but I'm actually really looking forward to it.
I read some of the cards, and I would say they did a good job in representing the feel of some of the characters in the rules of the cards, like Abaddon's rules, like Imhotep the Stormlord, especially. I think his rules, so his the traits they gave him on the cards, I think are really well reflected of how that character feels. So at the very least, whoever their correspondent, like whoever Wizards of the Coast was working with at G-Dub, knocked it out of the park.
Seemed like, and there's some reprint effects, you know, from other in Magic's history, and there they are. You know, if you can get them, you can play them all together. You get all the decks, you could actually play them with your group of friends and never need to get another card. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they come pre-constructed and all themed out. And, you know, great kind of evening or kitchen table type experience and still play with some really cool effects. One of the things that stood out to me, though, was that, you know, the stats on some of the creatures and how it compares to some stats. Every creature in the game in Magic the Gathering has like a power and a toughness.
Yeah.
And so let's take Silent King as an example here. You know, he's like a 3/4 or something. You know, there are creatures that are 3 times, 10 times more, you know, with a higher stats than that character. But that's kind of neat. This like the weird balance in between what we know as a Warhammer 40,000 stat line and what is powerful versus to what is powerful and might work in another game.
Yeah, as a representative, because of course, you know, translating something like the Silent King into a card, you're never going to, I mean, how do you possibly try and represent that? So they got to work within their own parameters, their own, you know, systems.
They did a pretty good job though. So the art looks cool.
Yeah.
You know, there's all that theming's there. You get even some differences to who you make your commander based on the, you know, the decks that you have in there. The way the commander format works is you have a commander, the deck has to be built off cards that share colors out of their color chart with the commander. And then you basically play a big game of Magic with a 100-card deck where each card can only be represented one time in the deck. So, you know, you get a lot of replayability, a lot of different things can happen.
And yeah, it's extremely replayable. And it's meant to be a multiplayer format, right? I've played a lot of, well, me and my brothers would just mess around playing 1v1 commander, and it never was quite as fun as 3 people, 4 people, what it's meant to be.
The things you're doing have board-wide, many players interacting with it or affecting many players. And then, you know, one game of commander, you could play for an evening, almost very similar to how you do a game before you go.
Yeah, true.
I don't know if this is going to like attract Magic players to play 40K or 40K players to play Magic, but I'd say there's a pretty big overlap of people.
Yeah, well, I don't know if this is a policy that G-Dub enacted, but if I had to guess, I guess this is something that Wizards of the Coast reached out to do. They've been doing a lot of these crossover, like we saw the D&D crossover recently with Adventures in the Forgotten Realms, a lot of stuff they reach out and try and... it's probably almost certainly from a marketing perspective saying like, hey, well, let's just make sure we're across all of nerddom and fan pools and whatnot. But from a... from a 40K perspective, I love it. I love getting the cool, flavorful, awesome bits of the 40K community injected into other communities, being like, hey, this is cool, check this out. Who the is about under the spoiler? Let's go. How about you? Well, guess what? There's about 19 different books you can read to figure out who this guy is, where he started, let's where he came from, why he's there.
Yeah. Wikipedia researcher.
Exactly. Just pull them in, fishing line style. Like, it's great.
I've already seen some of my 40K friends getting ready for this release and sort of like practicing Magic the Gathering and like buying a few cards here and there. So I think in terms of like Wizards of the Coast, I think that it will probably bring in a bunch of new players. It'll be really interesting to see if a bunch of people from Magic come into Warhammer.
Well, it's so almost same, but different. I love it. I love little fandoms and nerddoms and seeing how they co-populate and seeing people from the outside looking in at what this does and how that's different. Yeah, it's fantastic.
Magic now, does have lore too. I mean, like, you're right. It kind of is the same. There is a rich kind of backdrop to the stories that doesn't always play into the cards, but sometimes it does, and that's the thing that keeps people really engaged.
Yeah, for sure. How much experience do you guys have with MTG? I know, Paul, you play quite a bit, yeah?
Yeah, I've been playing since the beginning of Magic, and you know, different levels of involvement over the period of time. And I don't mind saying this, you know, several years ago when you know, the information was coming less from Games Workshop. You know, there was a time, you know, you only got one or two codexes a year and, you know, there wasn't a lot of news and info coming. My brain needed that engagement. And so I kind of got back into Magic at that point in time.
My experience with Magic is kind of weird. So I played a little bit of Kitchen Table Magic with my husband about 8 to 10 years ago. But my husband used to buy boxes and then like sell the singles essentially. And he did really well. Like it was a pretty lucrative side business for us. So I'm kind of more familiar with the buying, selling, trading sort of aspect of things than I am with the actual gameplay aspect of it. So I'm really interested. Like I am actually going to go probably read some of the cards and see like what the mechanics are in this set and things like that. But I wonder if these cards will have collectible value or if there's so many on the market that they'll sort of like not hold their value.
Just be printed into oblivion is what you is what you're thinking. Is
it? Yeah. Yeah, it'll be really interesting to see like just how they kind of like fit into like speculators' plans and things like that.
There are some unique effects or reprints in these sets that are going to be legal in certain formats outside of Commander or just outside of playing Warhammer Commander.
Interesting.
And so if this, not to fuel the speculators out there or what have you, but it would be very difficult for Wizards of the Coast to reprint some of these cards, in my opinion. I don't know. I do not know all the logistics behind the things, but it could prove difficult to reprint them. And so if those effects become desirable, then that makes them collectible, especially as the further we come from the release date.
Mm-hmm. It'll be really interesting to watch.
I always get fascinated by the marketplace, like you mentioned, Tanya, the MTG marketplace, like the buying and selling, you know, what's got value at the moment, how much is this card going for, what's that going to be worth out of this box set, et cetera, et cetera. And I've always wondered when there would be that for GW, there would be that for the Citadel miniatures. And it's actually a couple. I actually know of, there's one guy, especially in Australia, is actually a couple that do, well, box splits, and whether you want to agree with such practices and possible scalping and whatnot, that's totally up to you. But I know one guy who almost has, I'm not sure if he's full-time at it, but there's a guy called Jack in Australia who exclusively like buys and sells used minis, like whole armies, buy them, split them, sell them, et cetera, et cetera. It's just cool to see that kind of aspect evolve as our game has gotten bigger, gotten more, I suppose, lucrative for many players. And also in Australia, I think it's absolutely freaking necessary that we have a thriving secondhand market, because Lord knows buying a whole new army.
Your plight is a real thing.
So chasing the meta in Australia, it's just so rough.
I'm not saying that I would pay an obscene amount of money for one of those original pewter female space marines. But I might.
But I ain't saying I wouldn't.
That's fair. So, with this, I'm really looking forward to it, and you know, playing with my friends, and just you know, have somebody playing with my like my sons, you know, those kind of things. Is they can kind of it's easier to for them to get into, and then we can you know have talks about oh you know you just played let's say Abaddon as an example, and talk a little bit about Abaddon, and then tap, do some damage.
I just love all the ways that nerddom captures imaginations, and I think what Wizards are doing and what GW's helped them to do is a really good way to capture imaginations. So many, I mean, they've taken so many evocative characters and put them in card form that what I said before about people just being like, they'll just love a card or love the art of a card, read a narrative for freaking Imhotep the Stormlord and just be like, well, I guess I have to buy this miniature now. And then, you know, a couple months later, we see him at an Adepticon or something.
Okay. Is the Silent King really like a 3/4 though?
Yeah.
Because like, yes. Wouldn't you see that and be like, okay. And then you go and you like read the books and you're like, shouldn't this guy be like a 10/10 elemental or something?
Well, it's, he has other stats and other things. So he really is more greater than just that stat line.
See, I've never found the Silent King to be especially killy, like offensively. I would have said he'd be like a 2/6 or a 2/7 or something. He's got he's got an extreme amount of wounds, doesn't do a hellacious amount of damage for his points comparatively to like, you know, say a Knight Crusader or something, which is around about an equivalence points. But he just lives forever and buffs the crap out of everything else in your deck is what I would assume he would have done. And he's pretty close to that though.
No, he's definitely got some like add-on effects that you can use that are going to be incredibly powerful. I mean, there's just stuff he can do. And same with some of the other named characters. They have really cool effects that, you know, are going to make it be fun to play on the tabletop. That's really what it is. It's like, these are fun to do if you get your combo off or whatever. You're going to enjoy doing it. And all the decks seem to have those abilities or something in there that you can lead up, you know, build up to, or, you know, really kind of get over for a round or two on the table.
It's cool. We've been talking about, because most likely the next time all four of us will be together will be possibly LVO this year. And we've been talking about, maybe we all get one of the MTG decks, and that can be our LVO activity.
Oh, that'd be really cool.
That would be really cool. And people can come and watch the FTN Commander game.
Commander game, yeah. Let's do it.
I've never played Commander before, so you'll have to... I have to go easy on me. Just joking. Don't go easy.
Well, one of the neat things is that because, you know, there are, you know, four or five people playing on the table, the rounds do take a bit of time to develop. And so you can kind of see how other people are doing it. And then it goes around the table a couple of times. Then you're doing the same thing everyone else does is, you know, drawing your card and seeing what you can do and line up with what's on the table.
I mean, I've played a little bit of Magic. Like, I understand like the basic mechanics, but that was 10 years ago and the game has changed a lot. So,
well, yeah. In the multiplayer games, you know, the action's not immediately back on you. So, you know, it gives time for anybody. I'm talking about anybody that would be trying to get into this or just kind of wanting to see what it's all about. You know, you have four other examples of people doing things happening on the table at the same time. So, you know, a little approachable, I think. This style of format is something that kind of grew out of a different way to experience the game. I don't want to say more casual because I don't want to, you know, cast any slights on the power Commander players out there. But it's definitely, there's ways to, people have used it as opportunities to build out just crazy themes and it's a fun thing in the hobby of Magic.
It was also a way to make a huge swathe of cards playable at the same time, whilst not making them overpowered because you're limited to one of each. So it was a way to activate everybody's backlogs because people who play, I mean, me and my brothers, I've got three brothers, and we used to do a lot of activities together growing up. We didn't have a lot of money, but we would do, you know, I grew up on a farm, we'd all do our chores, and we went through a phase where we did our chores and we got to buy a booster. And so I think it was the Odyssey or the Invasion cycles. We just, every week, me and my brothers would run to the game store with our little pocket monies and we'd buy our boosters and see what we got and trade and build our decks and stuff. And so I've got cases of cards still from 20 years ago, and Commander means I can still play all of them.
Yeah
it's great. Cool. That. Yeah,
I'm completely looking forward to this.
So
gonna be 40K, tapping, hey? Yeah,
40K.
Yes, going jumping back over into our main subject, Warhammer 40,000, Man of These Leagues of OTAN.
Whew.
Creating some ripples,
spicy
in the community.
How do they feel about being called stunty? So we were going to talk about the fluff a bit this week. I've learned some things. Well, I was gonna ask questions of Paul, because I assume Paul would be the most likely one of us to have let it seep in.
Our fearless leader, the knower of all things 40K.
Read a bit of the lore, yep.
So, where have they been in the fluff for the last X amount of whatever?
I told you, out there in the high level zone.
The high level.
Low stature, but high level.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I did most of this stuff I was reading around the Ancestor Cores and stuff, you know, like that with, you know, the fact, you know, and there's been a lot of stuff coming out about how, you know, a little bit of a slight retcon about them selling the Ion technology to the Tau and keeping the best stuff for themselves. There is a Lore Master episode out on Warhammer Plus.
Nice.
Yep. So people can enjoy it that way. This is, you know, I will say, though, it's kind of hard to kind of be focused on that when there is just so much speculation about how powerful these guys are going to be on the tabletop.
It's everywhere right now. It's every medium that we communicate in. People are talking about how good they're going to be. Are they a problem? What needs to be done?
And, you know, there is, we talked about the judgment. By the way, if you're listening to this show, Forge Narrative, you now have a judgment token. If you listen to us on the Thursday show, that's one more judgment token.
That's the second judgment token.
Yeah. If you go to eat breakfast tomorrow morning, you're getting a judgment token.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to say, if you give us a 5-star rating.
Judgment.
No, we'll remove one. That's the only way to remove one is if you give us a 5-star review.
Can you remove one if you buy a t-shirt?
Maybe if you get a t-shirt, that might be. It's a good t-shirt idea, actually, I think.
Token on a t-shirt. That's
freaking, so getting judgment the judgment tokens is, I don't want to say it's if your opponent is interacting with the game and then you've got, you know, the characters that are able to dish out the judgment tokens, it's pretty easy to get judgment tokens on units. And then when the judgment tokens are on the unit, then it's pretty easy to stack them up to make that one of the more of the actual super core mechanics of the game, the wound roll, less relevant. And that is really what everyone is nervous about right now.
Nervous is like the understatement of the century.
Very gentle wording by Paul. People. So I mean, I said this in the pre-show. I think something that automatically gets a lot of players' backs up is when they read a codex that ignores a mechanic of the game. The same thing happened with Miracle Dice. Same thing happened with Fate Dice. And when you have an army that literally, an army that you across the board can just play without needing to roll a wound dice, people automatically be like, well, I have to play with the rules. Why do you not have to play with the rules? Rabble, 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 rabble. And it can just go from there. Not saying it's wrong, not saying it's right. I'm just saying this is a thing that happens.
That's a fine criticism too, or at least a fine thing to discuss or give some good-natured ribbing to your buddy who's playing this faction kind of thing.
Yeah. So,
and it's not that they don't have to never roll to wound. It's if you roll a 4+ when there's 3 judgment tokens on there.
You can play in such a manner that that rolling to wound is never a thing that needs to occur. Like, you never need to go to a wound roll to do the job. You know, the job is done and the mission accomplished at the hit roll stage of the interaction.
Yeah, 80 or 90% of your successful hits will wound.
Yeah. Yeah.
And which is not something that all other factions have. Some factions do have it. So,
and in doing that, they ignore a multitude of the best defensive interactions we have in the game, namely being the transhuman-like effect. It's completely negated, completely ignored, might as well not exist in that matchup. And the fact of the matter is, a lot of armies rely on insulation during the wound roll to not lose units, to have things that feel defensible. Once again, transhuman is a perfect effect. And then, once again, on top of that, we have armies like Harlequins, you know, the light sated Harlequins that, you know, can only be hit on 4s. Well, the 4s to hit is the only mechanic that I need. So you being minus to hit, you being plus to hit, doesn't really matter. As long as I can roll 4s, I can do damage. And so it's meaningfully ignores their defensive mechanics as well. Then when you extrapolate onto that, the fact that they can do a lot of mortal wounds with their beam weapons, they ignore invulns and have splash damage with their magna rail weapons. You just see that
they can trigger off of some judgment tokens being applied. I mean, it is. Yeah. It's now look, I actually think that's a little bit well, it's incredibly powerful, and it really is, but it is going to be less prevalent, I think, than we actually see it on the table. And it will be some weeks before we see it on the table. So there's
agreed. I mean, everyone who's saying the sky is falling at release immediately, you need to take a bit of a step back and realize that there is no knowledge of when the full release of the line is coming. So you're going to have some time to experience this codex before it gets every single one of the models in the range. I mean, the Berserkers and the Land Fortresses are considered to be the two most oppressive portions of that book. And I'm using this generally speaking because there are a lot of I think everything in this book is fantastic. I think this is one of the best internally balanced books that GW has ever produced in the history of the game. Everything in this book is good, is usable, is takeable, is fantastic. In saying that, it's going to be a while. You're going to get to have a bit of a taster of this book before it gets the full range in action and before it gets to its maximum peak. And so if it is a problem, it's going to be really flagged before it gets to the crescendo, so to speak. So, and I love that I just did a Harlequin reference and then got to crescendo in here. But you see what I'm saying, guys? Like the hyperbole. Yes.
I come from it from, I guess, a bit of a different kind of angle, right? So I had, because I sort of took a bit of a step back from playing 40K because I noticed that I myself was becoming this like rage-fueled internet ranter when everything was coming out and like the internet went up in flames and it was all doom and gloom and it was just sort of like happening like one release after another. And I started to notice that when I would get so upset, it was like I had blinders on to the experiences of my friends and how they felt while they were talking to me about the game. Right. And like, I just took a look one day. I think I was actually talking to my friend Kaylee, who we had on the community spotlight, I think a couple weeks ago. And I noticed that I had just taken wind out of her sails, essentially, while we were talking. And I was like, this is not how I'm acting is not good for me. It's not good for my friends, and it's not good for the community as a whole. And I think when that happens, there's a number of things that you as an individual can do. And the step that I took was I took a step back because I wanted to give my friends the opportunity to enjoy their toys and not listen to my rage, essentially. There's other things that I think that you can do, but at the end of the day, like basically like all of this rage that's on the internet right now, I just like it is just a game. We have gone through it a number of times. If you're like me and you're feeling like a little exhausted at this cycle of like new release being extremely powerful and then being fact and then the next one's extremely powerful and being fact, you can just take a break, you know, or you can decide to like maybe not play competitive anymore. My husband had a game at the game store with a friend and they played Highlander style, right? So you can't really take a super tuned list and it's more fun experience. Yeah.
And there are a lot of rules that come with Highlander, and it is a very, I mean, one of them being you have to both yell out there can be only one before you roll to see who goes first. That's mandatory. It is. But it is a cool rule set. That doesn't get a lot of attention at the moment because especially when GDEB came in and during 8th edition, 9th edition especially, tried to standardize the way in which we play the game, as in there's one almost universally adopted mission set, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, there are a lot of other ways to gain enjoyment out of this game. I applaud you, Tanya, for your maturity and what you said because I heartily encourage everybody to do the same. One of the best things about this hobby, it's holistic. You can enjoy it on so many different levels in so many different ways. If you're not enjoying it in one way of the game, look to the other aspects of this hobby that brings you joy. Modeling, painting, fluff, just hanging out with your mates is generally what I enjoy about the game the most. And so I played all the way through 7th, I played all the way through 8th, and I've now played all the way through 9th, and nobody can look back at any of those editions and say it has been balanced for the majority of the time, you know? That's just not a thing we can say. Has it been enjoyable? Absolutely, because I've made a conservative choice and I If you feel free, I mean, you are a customer of a game, you're a player of this game, you put your love, your money, your time, and your effort, blood, sweat, and tears as well for some people, you know, especially content creators like Paul and others who literally just give up their free time, hundreds of hours, thousands of hours a year. You've got to find other ways to stay motivated, to stay enjoyable, and to find reasons to continue. But at the same time, make a decision to change your perspective. Say, hey, if I'm not enjoying this aspect of this hobby, this aspect of this thing that I am so invested in, and you wouldn't. So here's the thing, yeah? You wouldn't be going onto the internet and arguing and being angry if you were going to quit the game. You would just walk away and quit the game. Mm-hmm. 90% of the time. You're angry because you're passionate, you're invested, and you don't want to walk away. You don't want to drop something that you love so much. And I love it. Every time I see the vitriol online, I'm like, I don't love what you're saying, but I love where it's coming from. It's coming from a place where I want things to be better. I believe they can be better. And I'm going to stick around in the hopes that they will be. I absolutely applaud it. I think it's awesome. I don't always like the things that I hear, the things that people say, but where it's coming from, I'm here for. That's one of the reasons I do everything that I do in this community also, and why a multitude of others do too. So find the things that still bring you joy that aren't reliant on a rule set, you know?
Well, specifically with the Votan here is that there are a bunch of different factors, and with things that we talk about on the show a lot, there's terrain placement. There is discussion with your opponents, you know, sometimes, especially if you're playing in your, you know, your basement or your kitchen table or whatever, you know, like, hey, can we try it without three of the land fortresses? Which, by the way, can you believe that, what is his name, Arkellan Land betrayed the Imperium and has given other people vehicles? There's no connection, by the way. I just thought it's funny. No, it's land speeders, no land raiders.
Well. It's just
well played. Well played.
Now so that, I think I saw that on a tweet or something. I'm not claiming credit for that.
So good, man. Well done.
In the slightest. But you know, you can have those types of conversations with your opponents. And the only time that you can't is at a tournament game.
Correct.
So, you know, That's only one aspect of this game that may be potentially not available to you if that's how you're choosing to play the game right now.
Yes,
and,
spot on.
You know, so just keep that in mind with some of the stuff that we're talking about and some of the stuff that you, you know, maybe reading. Now, granted, you can empathize and sympathize and even agree, you know, with some of the folks that are voicing it in that way. But like the only time you're really going to encounter them or these issues is in that one specific setting or format. And, you know, what we've seen is that Games Workshop wants to have a nice environment for all areas of play and will seek to correct that if there are major problems.
I would just like to remind people that there are people who are going to be returning to the game after a long hiatus because of the release of the Votan. There's going to be extremely hobby-minded folks who are really excited about Votan. So
a lot of folks named Carl coming in.
Yep. Be like, finally, it's my time.
But just sort of read the room, both in person and in your digital spaces. And if you are noticing that you're having a negative impact on those people, maybe just take a step back, you know, maybe just reassess how you're expressing your own disappointment, because it might be better for both parties, you know?
Yeah, well said. Yeah, I agree with that. I just, you know, we'll see how it all shakes out with the rules. And then, you know, come up, the terrain, you know, there's a lot of the stuff is, they don't really have a lot of ways to ignore line of sight. And I don't think they deal with assault armies all that well.
They don't deal with offensive speed very well. They want to, so just to talk about the crux of things, I don't have a solution. I can't give you a silver bullet for Votan. I can give you some ideas and some concepts of things we've done against armies that came into the game and brought similar questions to their opponents. Tau being a great example of something that is similar. Iron Hands in 8th edition, great example of something similar. These ultra durable fire-based armies that have oppressive firepower. Now, a lot of people have said Votan are slow. Yeah, I actually do not prescribe to that. I think they are pretty much the same speed as Space Marines. And if you call Space Marines slow, fair enough. I think they're an average speed army. I don't think they're slow. I don't think they're fast. They're about average. And most of that's because they take away a lot of the variance when they advance. And if they want to get to the middle of the table quickly, they can through scout moves, use of bikes, etc., redeploys, so to speak, if you go down that league. But speed is good into them because they're a shooting army. Their combat is pretty much exclusively to chain to three different data sheets, one of which is a character who you can dodge pretty well. You can only be in one place one time. The other one being their, was it the Hearthguard, their Terminator equivalents?
Yes.
Who aren't phenomenal in combat. They're good, but they're not as good as other elite, super elite melee units. They're very respectable, but it's the Chthonian Berserkers. Horus's own Chthonian Berserkers.
It is not.
Shush! Can't convince me.
All right, fine, fine. I don't need to bring logic into this.
Why are they from Chthonia? They know what they're about. Anyway.
That's the street they live on.
It's that's their cluster. My joke is that it's one of the Votan heads is Horus's head. They've got like a clone head of Horus, and they're all the Chthonians are like paying homage to it because he's telling them how to be reavers and stuff. But they're the one you got to worry about. Like if you think of all the issues Repentia bring to you, think Repentia slower slower to close with you, but harder to kill is kind of what Chthonian Berserkers bring to the equation. So if you can navigate them, or if you can shut them down, or have ways to mitigate what they do to you, either by having Ultra MSU hitting in waves, that's a good way to go about it. One of the best armies that I think in the game that's going to be the best here is Harlequins, because they close the gap very efficiently. They have redeploys to go. If you're going second, you can deploy to go second, then you can redeploy to go first, et cetera, or vice versa, if you want to be. And they just have the speed to close, and everything's a transport. So they've got to waste time killing a transport, killing the contents, killing the transport, killing the contents. I don't think bikes work as well for the Harleys in this matchup. I think what you want is just as many Star Weavers full of troop as you can, close the distance, gum them up, and try and keep them in their deployment zone while you run away with the primary score. And that's pretty much my tip ubiquitously is play the primary. Their secondaries aren't great, but if you keep them from playing a good primary score, you can get close. I'm not telling you this is how you're going to win. Like I said, no silver bullets yet.
How are you leaving Blood Angels out of this?
I'm not. I'm Blood Angels. I think Harlequins do it one step better than Blood Angels because they just have more stuff. I think MSU is the better way to combat this than having, you know, your big Sangar units,
units that can be beamed out or manually.
Exactly right. Yeah, exactly right. You don't want that. You don't want to give them max return for like their big single shot weapons. You want to make their single shot weapons pop a freaking rhino, you know? And they're like, cool, that didn't hurt me too bad. Let's go off. So maybe a Blood Angels absolutely can do this. And one of the great things Blood Angels have is Fury of that Death Company. That Death Company turn one charge.
Forlorn Fury to go over there and get rid of the fortresses just off the table.
Yeah, just go and just whatever they got, smash it. Another good thing is wherever they're putting their Chthonian Zerkers, I mean, they'll fight on death with you when you kill them, but if you can go and get rid of them early so they don't have a counter charge, that's a great thing too. Also, Paul is the biggest proponent of this I know. Look in your codex, find ways to stop stuff from falling back. Yeah, a lot of codexes have like 4+ on a chance, living on a prayer, you can't fall back from me. I know Black Templars have it. I know a bunch of codexes have something similar. It doesn't get used that much because people don't want to bet a game on a 4+ roll, but this might just be where Votan puts you. So if you have that in your codex, if you have access to something similar like that, give it a go. See if it works for you. See if you can play in a manner in which that can be something that can define a game.
Yeah, I think you're right. These will present problems, and a lot of codexes have things that have not been choice units because they haven't been a requirement for them.
Yeah.
Maybe there's some things in there. So, you know, again, a lot of time before we see the full might of the Votan on the tabletop. I think once you start dealing with things like terrain, and there are armies that are out there already competing in the meta, you know, even as we speak, that are, you know, you know, one tier, they're coming, you know, they're going 4-1 or whatever. They have what it takes, I think, to stack up decently well against what we've seen or what we can kind of assume from this force right now. But make no mistake, it is powerful. They have some incredibly good effects, and they're going to be reliable. I kind of argue, though, that I don't know that it's any more reliable than some of these reroll hits, reroll wounds that are being dished out. A lot of models.
I mean, you see a big unit of Crisis who's just hitting on threes, rerolling, winning on twos, rerolling wherever they want, and you're just like, well, they don't really work with dice either. They're just throwing math. So
they are at least rolling though.
One of the, sorry, and this is me personally throwing my salt in the arena. When you build a mechanic that ignores another mechanic, like when you build in like an army-wide auto on a hit roll ignores a wound roll, you want to not give them incredible ways to re-roll to hit, yeah, or to have plus to hit, or you don't want to give them a huge swathe of mechanics that make that hit roll better because they already operate off the hit roll. You don't want to make that hit roll so good math-wise that the mechanic is just the only thing that matters. Like that mechanic gets doubled down, tripled down, even quadrupled down upon on the multiplier about how good you can make that mechanic. And because Votann have so many quality ways to reroll to hit, that's why the judgment tokens feel a little worse. If I was to talk about ways to maybe curb Votann in the future, J-Dub, if you're out there, removing a bunch of the ways or nerfing the ways that they have full rerolls to hit and changing them to reroll ones to hit would be a strong way to do it.
There you go. Let's take a quick break, and I want to remind everyone that if they've made it this far, they have just earned themselves a judgment token.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
We'll see y'all in a minute.
FTN is brought to you by Discount Games Inc. Please visit them at www.discountgamesinc.com. And don't forget to ask Jay about ways to save even more on your hobby projects.
Hey, everybody, we are back. Got Adam and Tanya here.
Well, hello.
So,
there.
I don't know that I can resist buying those Necromunda Goliath bikes that they put out.
The big wheels?
Yeah.
It's freaking cool.
You know what? Okay, so I play Escher in Necromunda, and I think that their hover bikes are really, really cool. But the orc community went insane when they saw those Escher bikes, right? Like,
the Goliath bikes?
No, the Escher, like, hover bikes. I haven't seen them talk about the Goliath bikes before, but, like, because the orc community tends to be very, like, conversion heavy, right? And I have not seen anything take the hearts and minds of a community like those Escher bikes did. So maybe
they've been out for a bit. That's right.
Yeah. So maybe I'll have to like drop some strategic pictures of these Goliath bikes into like certain Discord channels and see what happens.
They are the Goliath Maulers. Yeah, I've been somewhat resistant to jump on the Ash Waves because I play this very, very casually and in very infrequently with other Necromunda enthusiasts, but the Goliath gang was my beginning of the pandemic project, and I actually finished that one.
It's funny that you bring up Necromunda, because I literally last night finished writing up my player pack for a narrative campaign that I am going to be running for Necromunda. And this is like my first anything that I've ever run. So I'm like doing a bunch of planning, and I'm actually really enjoying like picking out the missions to tell the story. But it's a bunch of new players, and I'm not sure if people understand like how crunchy Necromunda is.
And that their models can die.
Yes. Yes. Like actually die at the end of each round.
There's a special hammer. They give it to you in the box set. Yeah.
The ritual hammer too. Yeah.
A single tear rolls down my face.
It's time.
To commit this ganger to memory here.
love it. It was a good ganger.
The models just look so good. I mean, that's one of the coolest things about the specialist games that have been revived and are getting the support and attention. That, you know, actual cool models. And there were some Forge World models that went over pre-order as well. But there's something about these Maulers that are calling me. Well, because they look so cool. It's not really that far of a stretch.
I was going to say, like, is there anything that doesn't call to you, though, in Necromunda? Because it's kind of where I'm at. Like, I have made a commitment to the Escher gang, so I'm not going to, like, buy anything for any other gangs just because I'd rather have everything for this gang. But it's hard. It is so hard with me, with Necromunda, to say no.
Well, with the campaign, how many players do you have in the campaign?
So far, there's 6 people who have expressed interest in playing.
Oh, that's pretty good. Do you, when you say you're writing it out, do you have like a length of time that you plan on running in a certain amount of weeks or?
Yeah, so everybody, like I said, everybody is sort of new to it, and everybody's got jobs and kids and stuff. So how I'm running it is each round, I'm going to make pairings. So round one, you'll have 2 weeks to play your game. You'll decide with your opponent if you want the ability to take prisoners. if you do, you have to play rescue mission before I make the next pairings in 2 weeks so that they have the opportunity to get their captives back, essentially. So then it'll be a 2-week round. You can play other games in there too if you want like extra reputation and stuff, but you make your own matches for anything other than the first paired match. Mm-hmm. So 2 weeks, and then 2 weeks you get another round. And then I'm going to have a recruitment phase where I give people extra credits. They can recruit new gangers in case everybody's dead. And then we'll do another 2 weeks with one pairing, and then another 2 weeks with one pairing. And then I have like an event for anybody who wants to play. So basically it's going to be like a 6-person. It's actually the pit fight mission where everybody nominates like one champion to fight in a multiplayer is what we're going to do.
This sounds freaking awesome.
That does sound cool. I like it that you've got the 2-week window there, because that's enough time to keep it on your radar of, you know, knowing you've got to play the game and participate in the campaign, but also maybe long enough to where if you wanted to make any modeling choices or add something to your gang or whatever, that's enough time to do that and not feel pressured probably.
Mm-hmm. So we've done leagues before, like non-competitive leagues, just like you play your matchups or whatever. And we always found that 1 week was not enough time for people sometimes to get that match in. So like 2 weeks was always sort of the sweet spot. And then I figured 2 weeks also, because there's always those few people who are super gung-ho, right? So those people can find each other in this sort of little league, and they can play each other as much as they want. They can accrue extra XP and like credits and things like that by playing whatever missions that they want. And then people who just don't have the time to do that, they don't have to do that. So that's my hope. I don't think anybody's going to play any games over and above their sort of matched play, but it's an option for those who want it.
I like that a lot.
Are you keeping it open as to what like factions and everybody can play, and are you going to...
Yep. Anything out of White Dwarfs, that's fine. I don't care. It's more narrative than anything else. And like Necromunda is not balanced anyway. Like I don't know if you guys have played a lot of it, but the missions themselves are like inherently unbalanced. I'm not too worried about it.
Are you incorporating the Ash Waste and that kind of stuff into it, or is it just the kind of the base?
So it's just the base. And in fact, I think that there's even players that don't have tactics cards. So for the missions, they're only allowed to use tactic cards if both players have access to a deck, because a lot of these players have never really played, or they've only played sort of like a teaching game with myself. So it's very streamlined. It's like very pulled back and just super relaxed. It really is going to be more about the story than anything else.
I just love how much consideration you've given to just all the different player groups. Actually beautiful. And I do want to point out there is a magic and mystical moment that happens in many gamers' lives when they run their first XYZ campaign, like your first D&D campaign, your first, you know, Necromunda campaign. Mordheim was the first one I ever tried to run, where you're just like, it's not reinventing the wheel. It's like, I get to use all my flair, all my crazy ideas, everything I ever thought that I ever might want to, you know, do in my own games. I get to see, you know, and give to other people. And it's, you haven't been... Everybody who's playing D&D for like more than a couple of campaigns has been let down. Everyone except it. Just know we're all in that foxhole together. But, you know, that first time you try and run something is the absolute peak of your enthusiasm. And I think it's always a beautiful thing.
See, I feel like I have played so much Dungeons & Dragons and role-playing games in general, which is sort of like why I am expecting everybody to do the bare minimum. Yes. in this narrative campaign, but I'm leaving the door open for them to do more if they so choose to.
Love it.
Yeah.
It's one of those to where, you know, maybe so, they're just going to be there rolling some dice if they're a distraction for the week or whatever. But, I mean, you never know. You could kind of spawn an interest, but someone's wanting to run the next campaign. That way you get to play you know, not have to worry about organizing.
I've noticed that there's a few people who don't really like to paint. And I think that they like the idea of only having like 10 models that they have to paint for this. I don't actually have any painting requirements, but most people are going to have painted gangs. So that's pretty cool.
It is neat that you can play a fully immersive experience and only have to worry about 15 models.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. What, you know, is that? That's crazy.
Yeah. And you could cycle between those, you know, or you can choose to, sometimes you want to build out your characters with maybe different weapon options. And it's cool to have them represented on the model sometimes, but you know, whatever. I've never met a Necromunda group that wasn't pretty flexible on some of that modularization.
Yeah. I think when the game has so many like keywords and rules and like alternative modes of play and things like that, I think you have to be somewhat flexible if you're going to play Necromunda, because it's not like a living rule set like Warhammer 40K. It doesn't really get erratas or anything like that. So sometimes you do just have to be like, well, we're interpreting this differently, so let's just flip a coin and move on. So yeah, I think that you do have to be like a little bit more chill, narratively focused. Until
death is on the line.
Until you got to take the hammer to your mini.
Yeah, until someone brings the hammer out and you just do what you got to do.
Like, wait a second. Let's go check the internet, see if there's been any clarifications.
Not ready.
That's pretty neat to get that done. And then it is, with just the cool models coming out, I'm kind of like, man, I got to get back into it too. And I'm not one to let a set of special dice go past me.
I do enjoy that Necromunda has special dice.
I feel like I'm missing out. Like, I always have to have them. If I'm even remotely interested in the faction and some special dice come out, I'm like, probably need to get these.
Need.
I think I found my forever dice. You know how people get into relationships and you meet the one and just like, that's my one. That's my person. I've tried many dice. I've rolled many dice. But then there's the store opening GW exclusive dice. They're black with gold pips, and they got a skull on the six. And I think they are my forever dice. They might be my forever dice. I have two sets of 20. Like 40 is pretty much all I'll need. I still have to start playing orcs for some reason. I think they are it. I think that's it. I'm sticking with them.
Those sound very nice.
They are beautiful dice. They're nice. So... I like that they're not rounded sides. I like that they're squared off. Like
they feel a bit more like edge?
They're a little bit more. They're not full square edge like casino dice, but they're not as well rounded as a lot of Chess X and other dice. Available?
Could you go give me some?
They're exclusive, Paul. I'm sure we may know somebody who possibly may have some lying around somewhere. Between us, we'll get you some between us. Yeah. Sure.
So, speaking of dice, I have two dice bags for playing Warhammer games. I have, like, the Forever dice bag, which has, like, my favorite objective markers and my favorite dice. But I have so many tokens for playing Nighthaunt, because they actually come with the book when you buy them, but they debuff units as you charge into them. So they all, you have to put these like little markers down, and there's so many of them. I hate picking them out. So
I get you.
Yeah. So I actually have two dice bags. There's like the Nighthaunt dice bag, and then there's everything else dice bag.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
That's nice. Well, that's going to be, so we're going to take a break. We're going to come back and do a community spotlight segment. I got some really cool folks that want to get on over the next couple of weeks, do a few more of these spotlights here and there. It's kind of neat to get a window into what's happening in other places in the community, in other shows. So they'll be wrapping up with Adam and Tanya. Look, I know we've handed out a lot of judgment tokens over the course of this episode. I'm going to say we can take them all back if you go check us out on Art of War Down Under, Be Nice Roll Dice, Art of War, and on the Thursday show. You can remove all those judgment tokens.
Or leave a 5-star review. And maybe you can give out a judgment token.
Yeah, if you know someone that listens and they have not given a 5-star review.
Yeah.
Maybe let them know. It's a possibility.
If you've given one and they haven't, you take your judgment tokens off and you just pass them on. Like, if you have three, you will give them all three. Yeah? And then, you know, that's their burden to bear.
Do we know that is bad news? Well, thanks a lot for listening so far. Hold tight. Going to come back. There's going to be a little bit more show left. And then we'll wrap up there. And, you know, Adam, Tanya, I'll see y'all next week.
See you next week.
Bye-bye.
See all of you.
You're listening to Forge the Narrative.
Hey, everybody, surprise! Like I said, we still got a few more minutes left with the community spotlight segment, this time with Archon Skari. Skari, it's been a bit since you've been on. Very happy to have you.
Thank you so much for having me, Forge the Narrative crew. And thank you very much. I appreciate it. It's always nice to be on. Nice to hear your voice.
Yeah, man. One of my favorite people in the hobby. We've had the opportunity to know each other for a bunch of years, teamed together. You know, some of the best ways to enjoy.
Wrong way, kids. Let's go.
Yeah. But speaking of ways to enjoy Warhammer 40,000, I want to talk about Crusade. You've been doing this, playing Crusade, for, I think, since the Drakari book came out. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Yes. Yeah, I love the Crusade mechanics, but I really got into it when the Drukhari Crusade rules came out. And that's when I really got involved in reading the different ways that armies kind of like play and stuff like that. And since then, I keep up to date with all the Crusade books. I read all the Crusade stuff for the different factions. And I've run quite a few different Crusade games/written a few Crusade campaigns.
Yeah, and you're playing in some, like, right now. Like, I think at least two. Can you tell me about what you got going on? And what you've done with them so far? Like, which campaigns, and then we'll talk about how they've played out and stuff. But if people aren't familiar with where they can find you, let us know where they can find you on Twitter and YouTube and that kind of stuff.
Absolutely. Yeah, we'll get to that. We'll get to that. But first, the big meaty potatoes of the Crusade. So I've been doing a ongoing series on the YouTube channel called A Rise of a Cabal, and it's about 13 or 14 games in, where I play my Drukhari Crusade, you know, and you can follow its development, playing a variety of different missions into a lot of different armies, anything from Space Marines to Tau to Necrons to Demons. And we play missions out of essentially any and all of the Crusade supplements that have been released. So as you see the little, like, Archon Skari essentially growing in power in the Dark City and building his, like, his little domain where he gets different territories that he captures and things. So that's one thing that I've had a lot of fun doing. I recently joined a local Crusade League that they started a few weeks ago here in Barrie, Ontario, where I reside. And it's at a store called Sir Games a Lot. And one of the players is organizing a little Crusade League. So instead of organizing it, for once, I get to play in one, which is really fun. And I'm just running my Dark Eldar in that one and taking a lot of the stuff I learned from playing 13 games and kind of starting from scratch. So that's always really nice.
Like which things to buy, which upgrades to focus on.
Correct. Yeah. Like when you play Crusade, you can, like, the whole point is to make your units, like, and your characters and things feel really legendary, if that makes sense. You know, you go around, and if you ever wanted to envision your warlord just beating up greater demons and things, there's like a way that you could, like, make it happen, which is kind of awesome. And so I've been doing that, and then I recently just started playing a little campaign. I'm going to be filming, I think it's 9 to 12 games with John, who I film regularly on the channel. He just finished painting and collecting some Thousand Suns and Chaos Zinch demons, and I've got my Primaris Black Templars that I haven't really had a chance to play very often, as well as Tanya painted me up this gorgeous Empress Champion for my birthday that was all the way in January. So she painted me up an Empress Champion for my Crusade, and I just had to put it in some games. And so Crusade was a great excuse to have an Empress Champion running around taking Chaos Champions heads. So that started filming. The first episode went up, I think, this week, and we'll be doing one or two episodes a week until the campaign's finished. But for that one, we're running it straight out of the book. We're doing the War of Faith from the Vigilus Alone campaign supplement, and we're playing missions and using the rules from there. So really looking forward to just playing it right out of the book and see how it works.
And that's the thing, did that come with, like, the Spiralbound book, like the smaller?
Yeah, so the smaller book is the War of Faith. So you've got rules for the missions in there, as well as how the idols work, because you have, like, religious icons on the table that have, like, an aura that affect your army or debuff the enemy, and you can pray to your idols to get bonuses while you play the game and stuff, which is really fun. And then you've got the main campaign book that has some of the Crusade rules for, like, a Space Marine Standard Bearer, you can like upgrade your banners and stuff to get cool abilities as they play through the campaign and things. So combining the two, it seems like we're going to have an absolute blast playing it.
Yeah, that sounds good. And again, tell me about, I guess, maybe how to get started with one. You mentioned you've ran one, and now, you know, I also get it. It's like the game master, you know, of a role-playing game, is that once you get known for running them, people are like, yo, can you set this up so we can also play? So it's kind of cool that you are now getting to just play without those responsibilities in there. But what's it like to set one up and get started?
So when starting anything, whether it's Crusade or making YouTube videos or doing a podcast, you have to get started. I think that's the hardest part, is to sit down and actually just do it. But if you want to play Crusade, you know, you can choose to do it either power level or points. I've heard of people playing Crusade with points instead of power level. We do power level because it's just easier and you can make your things WYSIWYG, like what you see is what you get on your models, and don't have to worry about like point values and things like that.
Yeah, is it 2 points over or whatever?
It doesn't matter. You know what I mean? Like, you're just playing, the missions aren't balanced. You know, you're not exactly playing a matched play style game. It's just for funsies sort of thing.
And you say they aren't balanced because there is some objective to be had, you know, that may not be, easily winnable, or at least equal footing on both sides.
Right. Or you have a unit that's upgraded 3 or 4 times. And, you know, they become way more, quote, powerful than what you get in the main book without any of the upgrades. Hmm. Right. So all in all, it's you're not playing like an equal footing game a lot of the times. Winning and losing has a very small impact in a Crusade game. It's all about trying to complete like your secondary missions, which in Crusade are called agendas. And each agenda gives your forces different ways of getting more experience points for things and things like that. So you're constantly trying to do your agendas, and you can normally pick agendas that you can complete even though you lose the game, right? So you're trying to like make your force progress and get cooler and more narrative and thematic. But at the same time, playing the game is just like a means to an end. And you end up just having a great time, like trying to get both your warlords to like face off in hand-to-hand combat, or, you know, little vendettas between units will form, and you're trying to like murder a unit that was a thorn in your side last game and things like that. All in all, it's a great time. So 50 power level or about 500 points is what you want to try with, to start with, and get a small table, like a little combat patrol style game is 25 power, which is half of that. And you can just play a couple of games and see if you like the experience aspect of the game.
And these are the pages that are in everyone's codex, is where you start building from.
In the middle of your codex, by the way. Unless you have like the Demon or Chaos Space Marines. But in the middle of your codex, every time you flip to it and wish that it wasn't in the middle of your codex, that's the Crusade rules, everyone.
I would say, I know that a lot of people do enjoy it this way, but I don't know. It's been a bit since we have broken it down about how to actually play. And one of the things that we kind of mentioned in the previous segment is that, yeah, a lot of the, you know, maybe concern and balance of things is a kind of a direct result of people playing tournament style games. Well, this is a way to still enjoy your models and play something far from a tournament style game.
Yes, exactly. You know, and it's one of those cool things where, like, normally when I need to paint something, I'm getting inspired about going to a tournament, and I need to, like, get an army list ready to go to a tournament.
I am an event-driven hobbyist.
Correct,
as well.
Me too. It's very, like, usually that fire, like, lights a fire up under my butt, and I'm like, I need to paint, you know, 5 tanks and 50 infantry by this weekend. And somehow it happens. Like, you might not be the best at painting, or you might not enjoy it too much, but if you need to get it done, like, it's crazy how much we can get done if we need to get it done.
Yes. Like, when you have 2 hours of actual hobby time, not scrolling, you know, on a social media app, or, you know, on a phone call or listening to something else, you are just, you know, focused
exactly
on that.
Yeah, 100%. But something that's really fun about playing just Crusade is I take it very lightheartedly. Like, if I want to use a model or a unit that I haven't used in a while, it's like the perfect time to just use that model that you converted or that you painted or that looks really cool, or is stepping on your friend's like Space Marine painted in his colors, you know what I mean, or in their colors, where you, or like with the trophy from like that you modeled onto the model or whatever, and just you kind of rub it in your opponent's face, you know, kind of rib him a little bit, and it's really fun.
Yeah, like an HQ model or something that you don't break out very often, but it does happen to have that helmet in the grasp of your opponent's
Correct. Color scheme. Exactly. That you put on there after many a battle of playing in the garage, you know, and it just, it kind of helps build those narratives and forge that those stories, right? Because at the end of the day, that's what it's about. It's about building those stories and kind of go, I feel like a lot of the Crusade really helps me from a personal level, kind of like detox from the competitive meta, right? It's just a great way to put models on the table and stop worrying about being hyper efficient and making sure you're making all the right choices to win games. Because that sort of mentality, although I enjoy it a lot, can be very draining, especially if it's nonstop.
Yeah, and everybody wants to win a game. Don't get me wrong. We're playing this to have to. I think that the dream for most people, myself included, is just to win more games than you lose. Doesn't always work out that way, but that's what's up. But this has some carryover effects with these agendas that go beyond just the success on that particular tabletop that day.
Yes, exactly, right? So those are and because it is lighthearted and a lot, and to be honest, credit to Games Workshop, they have gotten very good at writing Crusade rules for factions that fit what you would imagine that faction wants to do in a campaign or in battle in general.
Give me an example of path progression for Archon Skari in standing campaign.
So with the Drukhari one specifically, the whole point is to have you have an Archon or a Succubus or a Homunculus who is an ascending, like they're ascending the structure of the Dark City, right? So there's this whole sort of like side quest that they're playing that has nothing to do with the games that you're playing on the table. It has to do with building territories in the Dark City. So after games, you get what are called raid spoil points, and you spend these raid spoil points to capture locations in the Dark City. And there's like 132 different locations that you can kind of build a little empire with. And they're anything from a witch cult arena to incubi shrines to scourge spires to like, you know, docks, right? Where they, you know, to have control of the docks and of, homunculus pits and things like that. And by controlling them, you get like bonuses when you play the game if you control, you know, multiples of the same type of ones. But it's like the whole point is gaining that power in a place that has nothing to do with like the game that you played. Like you're getting spoils of war, but you're using them to sort of like, you know, get bigger in Komora, essentially. Mm-hmm. And what's really fun is the mechanic there is every time you take a territory, you have to take what's called an out of action test for your Archon or your Ascendant Lord. And on a one, they suffer a battle scar as if they would have died in battle as somebody tries to assassinate them as they like do political machinations to like climb the political ladder, mm-hmm. which is so every single battle scar that my Archon has not been from battle. It's literally been from all the like backstabbing political stuff in the Dark City as he like builds his empire. And it's really, really fun to have something like that, like play. And things like Necrons, they get better at reanimating and Thousand Suns, they're really good at like casting psychic powers and they're looking for knowledge. And so, and even in the Demons book, if you're playing a full Demon Crusade, you can have the different gods compete with each other for like glory points. And they're essentially trying to be the best god of the gods of chaos, essentially, which is really cool.
Oh, that is fun. Because we all have our favorites, you know.
Exactly. Exactly.
I'm digging this. So thanks for coming on and talking about this. If people were to start, I know you said, you know, starting is just starting. Well, where would you encourage them to begin as far as like assembling their force or looking in to where, to how to start building?
So what I would do is don't worry too much about all the nuances, right? Essentially build a little force, find somebody to play the missions right out of the main rule book. You know, you don't have to get super fancy and just, and play like two or three games with it so that you understand. Cause a lot of the times the hardest part is the, end game stuff where you try and like give experience to everybody.
Like your bookkeeping.
Exactly.
The carryover stuff in between the things that.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay.
So keep the game small, do the bookkeeping stuff a couple of times, and that should give you the confidence to then just scale it up. And once you get the hang of it, it's quite fast and a lot simpler than it seems at first.
Well, do you need to play a full-on campaign? Can you just play a couple of games and see if you like it? Like, you don't have to have, or do you have to have a story in mind before you get going, or can you just...
You can literally just start playing games. And that you don't really have to like play into any of the stories or add anything else to your campaign. But if you just want to have, you know, your guys gain experience and get a battle honor here or there and potentially a battle scar and just remember it in the middle of the game, to it'll just impact the games that you play in the future. Right?
An excuse to put some more purity seals or whatever on your squad. Nice. Hey, that's our show this week, everybody. Skari, thanks for coming on and closing this out with us with a little bit of a palate cleanser from some of the stuff we were talking about earlier. Now, where can people find you? I want people to be able to follow along because you post pictures of this stuff and have, you know, cool content of your own that people may enjoy seeing if they're not familiar with you already.
Awesome. I appreciate it. Well, you can find me on Instagram, Skaredcast, so SKARED CAST. I'm on Twitter. I put tweets up every once in a while at Skari2. And from there, you can find my YouTube channel and whatnot and the Patreon as well, which is, you know, if anybody wants to support what I do, that's literally how you can support me. And on YouTube, I do videos there. And with Mini Wargaming, I do a lot of filming too. So I'm all over the place.
Sweet, man. It's been a blast. Always enjoy speaking with you. Everybody else, don't forget to like, share, and subscribe. We will see y'all next week.
Scan is clear. I think they're gone. For now.